This is Viv Sutherland, and welcome to Women's Studies. We have, again, this week is our guest, Robin Morgan, whose poem you heard last week, and which I find, if the rest of the poems in your new book are going to be anywhere near like that, I can tell that it's going to take me a long time to read the book. Because I'm going to have to take them in very small doses. It's quite a powerful work.
Thank you.
I asked Robin to be here today, not only to talk about that poem and about other poems, but also to do some dialogue with me about the women's movement and where the women's movement is going, about the way feminists, and that word is, of course, in quotes, relate to each other, and to talk a bit about the article she wrote for Ms. Magazine September.
Yeah, it was written, actually, the previous June, but then came out in the September issue.
Right. It's, for those of you who save your copies of Ms. religiously, it's the one with the hourglass on the cover, and I found this article to be something that I felt was desperately needed, because it talks of the way women and the women's movement relate to each other. It talks about how we treat each other. It talks about what I call feminist fascism.
You're a brave lady.
I have discovered after 30 years that I can only say what I say, what I think, and I
yes.
can only be what I am. And I think this article also speaks to that. The fact that that accepting yourself for what you are is perhaps the first real step.
Yes. Well, I mean, I tried to do that in that article, and try in the poems. I mean, one tries in all aspects of one's work and life, obviously, big platitude. But it's just that, you know, saying things that are critical of ourselves as women, particularly in a feminist context, as conscious feminists in a feminist movement, is always very scary, despite intellectual assurances from oneself and everybody else that obviously good criticism is necessary and mm-hmm. healthy. And I think it's scary for a number of reasons. I mean, one is that it hurts. Mm-hmm. One is that there's so many ways that one can give or feel one is getting criticism for a million wrong reasons, you know, mm-hmm. moral superiority and the one-upmanship games and one-up womanship, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the very objective one, which is that we are, as individual women and as a people, besieged, you know, from the outside every day by the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And so it, at an emotional level, it can seem disloyal, you know, to admit or confess that there is really anything wrong. Even though, again, intellectually one knows that not to do so is death. And I think that that there is not a political group, a revolutionary group, perhaps a human group, that is not capable of fascist forms.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that you are right in characterizing, you know, certain obsessions with correct line thinking, with no variance, with molds,
mm-hmm.
To be fascist kind of thought. And that's very startling, to all of us, because we thought we would be different.
Uh-huh.
You know? Uh-huh. I still think, given the size and the breadth of the women's movement, that by comparison, that tendency, you know, that super correct tendency is really quite small. I mean, when one looks at other political movements that are mass movements, and one sees what has happened to them, I mean, suddenly, by comparison, women's movement seems just marvelous. I mean, that kind of just nastiness has never really gotten as much of a foothold as it could have done.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it seems to, something sane rises to counter it. Usually in groups of women that live outside of big media centers in big cities and are just, you know, simply too interested in surviving and getting their rape crisis center started or their child care center or their this or that, and who don't have time for internecine warfare. But a lot of what is really internecine warfare passes, I think, for struggle, which makes it all the more frustrating, because when there are genuine struggles going on, to differentiate and respect and really confront and engage those, which is necessary,
mm-hmm.
That differentiation, I think, becomes much more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, I was having a discussion with a friend of mine who is sort of peripherally caught up in the struggle that is going on within the National Organization for Women,
mm-hmm.
Both on the national level and the local level. And she is terribly worried about what is going on, and there is some cause for concern there. But my point, my thoughts on the subject were that, well, that's fine. If they want to pick at each other, if they want to, that was two words, that was pick at, not carry around. If they want to pick at each other, if they want to expend a lot of time and energy worrying about what the other side is doing or thinking or feeling, that's all right for them. But I personally want no part of it. I have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
I have this radio show to put together, and I have other things which I feel will directly benefit women as a whole, and mm-hmm. the women's movement in particular. And frankly, I just don't want to be drawn into it. For two reasons. Primarily because I think it's just an expenditure of energy that I cannot afford to expend, and also because I do not necessarily see that the solution as it exists, that the problem as it exists, has a solution.
Yes, well, I think that's very true. I mean, I think that's true of, well, God, most of the problems, you know, that exist. I think that simple-minded approach of, if something is a contradiction, it has to be, that contradiction has to be, you know, wiped out that moment.
Right.
Everything must be consistent. Every, you know, problem must have a solution, sort of like third-grade math.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very sophomoric. There are going to be some contradictions which will last through the feminist revolution, and in fact, some of which will not even evince themselves until after it. And I mm-hmm. think, in fact, as long as there is sentient life anywhere in the universe,
right.
there are going to be contradictions,
mm-hmm.
and I celebrate those. I don't see what there is to run in mute terror about from them. But in some groups, it became such a dirty word that all somebody would have to stand up and say, ah, but that's a contradiction. And rather than people then saying, well, that's interesting. Now, let's look at why it is and how it is and whether that should be affirmed in this case or whether one side of the contradiction is more emphasizable than the other or what is the cutting edge of which contradiction here. Instead, everybody sort of acted as if an earthquake had occurred and the contradiction either had to be denied or a solution, a pat solution,
yes,
had to be found immediately.
Yes.
And that's just absurd. I mean, each individual alive, and in particular, with relation to the, to me anyway, root problem of the species, sexism, each individual, particularly in relation to that problem, is extremely complex. And the solutions are multitudinous. The possibilities are multitudinous. The failures are multitudinous. The attempts and, oops, that doesn't work out, let's try another route. I mean, we have really only begun for the 12th million time to try to find out what those are. And we're not going to do it overnight. But I mean, that is a challenge that, it seems to me, is to be celebrated, is to be affirmed. There's a fine line of Yeats, the fascination of what's difficult. And that, for me, is very true. We never, any of us, thought it would be easy, did we? I mean, this making of a feminist revolution, this freeing of one half the world, and by that freeing, the saving of the other half, that's Emmeline Pankhurst's words, it's very complicated. And it cannot be easily reducible.
It's while you were speaking, I flashed on an image of skiing, of all things. Skiing is a sport that many people profess to love. And the best part about skiing is not taking a slope that is full of lumps and ironing the lumps out before you come down it, right? The best part of skiing is working around and over and through those lumps and to some extent with them.
Yes.
That's the fun of it. If all ski slopes were straight and smooth and you know, at a perfect angle, I don't think anybody would bother with the sport.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder why, when people seek out difficulty to amuse themselves with, why they quail at it in life.
That is interesting. I suppose because, I mean, the underlying concept is that there it's a game. Mm-hmm. So if it becomes too difficult, or if you get bored with it, or if it, you know, scares you, you can always stop and not lose face because it's a game. But, my God, over here, this is real life, or this is, you know, real politics. This is serious, big. We're grown up over here now, and we have to really, you know. And we can't take those risks, and we cannot allow somebody else to perhaps try. And this is where, you see, for me, pure politics becomes very, in its broadest sense, becomes very involved with, I don't know what else to call it, but a feminist metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of only evolving in my mind. I'm going to be dealing with this more and more in the prose books. Metaphysical, all right, the combination of something that is extra, other than physical, and let's say the real political world, unquote. I think that male revolutions have always been very materially centered, as if it was by bread alone. And there's something peculiar that has happened whenever such revolutions have been won, which is that certain things don't get dealt with, among them women, children, the problems of racism, art, real changes in culture and the way people really relate to one another. All right, I mean, I happen to be a woman, a feminist, a mother, and an artist. Now, that makes me concerned about those areas I just mentioned, not that there are not many others. Mm-hmm. And stand a good chance of being put in jail at, let's say, a classic male-led revolution. Why is that? I mean, why is there such a fear, let's say, of art? Is it because art seems effeminate and womanly? Why are there even male artists, let's say, in revolutionary prisons all around the world, including this country today, not even to speak of cases like the Three Marias? All right. Is it because art seems womanly and effeminate, or is it because art seems like a game, apropos of what you were saying earlier, that it is not serious enough? Right. Now, to me, a feminist metaphysics dares to see that, among other things, existence is, and I mean this with a capital G, a game, a great and glorious and infinitely complex and unmistakably dead, serious game.
That's right.
The way that children play, you know, I mean, adults seem to feel that when one plays, one doesn't have to be serious, which is really crazy. I mean, children, when they are really playing, are much more intense and dead serious than they are when they're, quote, working at schoolwork or cleaning up their rooms. Right. And they reserve the most intense concentration for play in the highest sense. Mm-hmm. And it's somehow, I think we have to learn to do that with one another as political feminist women, in creating a feminist culture, in creating a feminist existence, a feminist space, and never to be ashamed of that, because what the hardline, solely economically minded, quote, radical will say is, ugh, art or, you know, culture, or what is all this feminist culture stuff, poems and music and books and blah, they should all be in the factories. All right. Now, what the ivory tower artist will say in the other extreme is, well, I simply have to, you know, write my poems. I couldn't possibly be bothered. There are 16 women starving to death on my doorstep, but that is of no consequence to me. And we stand a unique chance as individuals, as groups, and as a movement, given our vision of refusing those two poles, those opposites, and of simply yoking together by an act of violent faith, as it were, those two extremes. At least that seems to me sometimes very necessary and sometimes even possible.
Well, your work epitomizes that. We were speaking before, I was saying that that all of the work of yours that I've come across is of a body, that it all speaks to all of its parts, and to all of the different fragments of what it means to be a woman and a feminist, and hangs them together.
I'm very glad that you feel that way, because I have certainly tried and will continue to try to have that integrity of work. It's like we were saying before that I think we need to become women of letters.
Yeah.
Instead of men of letters, and to refuse those distinctions, let's say, in terms of literature that patriarchal literature has thrived on. I mean, if you are a poet, you're not supposed to write plays or prose or nonfiction or fiction. I mean, you're supposed to do just that. Or if you are a novelist, you are not supposed to. And there have always been great artists, female and male, who have simply said, oh, fiddle, you know, to those clearly marked out demarcation lines. But they have usually had to pay in some extra heavy spiritual price for daring. to do that. And I see more and more the possibility of that becoming a norm out of what I'm calling feminist culture than it being the exception, which I think is very good.
Certainly it would seem that the feminist movement is the only such movement to even attempt.
I think so. I think
so. To tie things together.
Yeah. To see linkages and echoes and refrains, which is I love as a poet, and I think I think things like refrains and themes are really at the heart of poetry. I mean, they were back in the days when poetry was chanted around the great bonfires, mm-hmm. And I think they still are. And to see that fragment of each of us in the other is not often, given to one. I mean, it doesn't descend as regularly as we would like it to on the deus ex machina, little pulley. But I see more and more women trying to invoke it,
mm-hmm.
Which is the most that one can do, and which itself is an act of courage, to dare to recognize, that in oneself, that in the other person, that in others, and to take one's time in terms of process, because I know just in terms of myself, there are things that I can dare relax and say now, confess, admit, affirm,
mm-hmm.
that I simply would have been incapable of doing 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Sure.
Yeah, and I know this is true of many other women. So we're also growing up, which I hope doesn't mean we are forgetting how to play. But maybe if we grow really mature, we'll first encounter how to play.
And is real maturity the ability to play? Maybe we've been doing it backwards,
yes.
All these years.
And or is it that we don't? I mean, perhaps the error was that we never knew when we were playing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I mean, have you not sat in, it's not so much in a CR context, but let's say an action group or a theory group or something like that, where games are clearly being played.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody knows that, really Mary is mad at Jean over there because Jean ran off with Mary's lover, and Mary's trying to be very adult and mature about it, but she's underneath, absolutely furious.
Mm-hmm.
However, she would never stoop to say, Jean, you ran off with my lover, and I really would like to kill you. Instead, she will say, well, I think that what you just recently said about the possible relation of Engels' theory of the family to feminism is less than relevant because blah, blah, blah. And yet it will come out with an absolute razor,
mm-hmm.
lacerating edge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody sort of knows there is, feminist game is being played here. But for Mary to say it, for Jean to say it, for even anyone else in the room to say, oh, hey, kids, is in some way not permittable.
Yeah.
Permissible. I don't fully know why. It's one certainly takes the risk of seeming less than serious. If you raise it, then perhaps you are the one that's being petty.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if Jean raises it, she's being defensive.
Right.
Right. And if Mary raises it, she's being self-critical, but she can also play that in a game sense so that she's co-opting the criticism before it comes at her. I mean, it can get very ornate, and no one can admit that it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, the way a child genuinely plays, the child never loses sight of the fact that the child is playing. It can be talking to itself at age 4 in the bathtub, taking 3 different voices, one for each washcloth as it is dialoguing with another washcloth.
Right.
But at the same moment, if you parent yells out from the next room, did you wash yet? Segueing instantly from one of 3 falsetto voices from the different washcloths, a child will say, no, but in just a second, and go back to Squeaky the Mouse talking to, the swan over. Why can we not do that? And why are we somehow so scared of the possibility of doing that, that it seems that, I mean, it makes it seem as if we would be less than serious feminists.
Mm.
What, in male eyes, for male approval? I don't know.
That's a good question.
I think that women have a better clue to playing than men do. Because men play their absolutely absurd games all the time. I mean, they call one war. They call another one
right.
football.
Right.
They have them. One is called diplomacy. But they never admit that. I mean, obviously men have died rather than admit that such and such is a game. So to win their respect, is it still a vestige of wanting that approval? I don't honestly know. I know that it's complicated in itself for me because I've also seen women use play as a cop-out. And the kind of play I think we're talking about, there's no way in which it can be a cop-out.
No.
It is dead serious. It is not frivolous. It is not a way to not deal with real suffering and to, go on fighting. There's nothing drop-out-ish about it. On the contrary, it brings you all the closer to some new set of truths that we've been tiptoeing around the edge of. But it's very strange. Anyway, I mean, probably in my own self-interest as a feminist artist, I feel that among those who will, be helpful mm-hmm. in urging this kind of experimental thought and interreaction of what I'm calling metaphysical feminism will be feminist artists. And that's one reason we need feminist culture. And if I hear anybody badmouth feminist culture, I will throw a poem at them or something. Militant.
I was talking with Margot Adler a week or so ago. Now, you are working on a book about Wicca.
Yes. It's a book of historical fiction, which will be called Tales of the Witches. And it's a children's book, although it's not written down.
Mm-hmm.
No Disney language for children. It's written mm-hmm. in adult vocabulary. Of fictional stories, but based on the real characters of real women and the plots taken from the records of the witch trials.
Mm. She, as I'm sure all the people who have ever listened to WBAI and who have ever heard her program, is, of course, quite interested in the subject and has done quite a bit of research and is writing a book currently on the relationship of Wicca to feminism.
I know, it's very exciting.
There is a great deal of interest in this topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a large part of this interest is due primarily to the fact that women are attempting to establish a feminist metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are doing separately and together is doing our own sort of internal and external research.
Yes.
to define this for ourselves and to create our own myths, our own worship, our own godhead within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, part of me is just in awe and in wonder that this can finally come about, because I remember, Margot talks about, and I can remember when I was a child and I began to have some sort of grasp on the goddess,
mm-hmm.
and then of course it went away,
yeah.
as it always does. And the thought of bringing that back through the women's movement is almost too terrible for me to think of.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that at times that part of the problems we have been having internally and part of the strife that we put each other through is an attempt to to stray away from this in order not to realize it.
Yeah. I think you're very right. I think it's as if when standing on the edge of a precipice, there's no paths, there's no models anymore, and no blueprints. I mean, one is stepping out into space, and it is terrifying. And it is, by comparison, so much easier to go backwards, even if one goes backwards into blueprints that have failed for women. Male capitalism, male communism, male socialism, male this analysis, male that, you know, whatever, that just have not worked. But suddenly it's a blueprint. Any blueprint, give me a blueprint, anything will do, rather than the void. And yet that's what does exist, and that is what at some point has to be encountered. Encountered, perhaps made meaningful. Perhaps the notion of its being made meaningful is itself really quite abysmally funny. But then that has to be looked at. And I only hope that in the excitement over our creating our own myths, our own sense of, what to say, Godhead, transcendence, that we don't settle for what Mary Daly has called, short-circuited transcendence, cheap grace, that we don't institutionalize and reify, as really everybody else has done.